Okay, so today I want to talk about some basic properties of signals, and I apologize for the problems because today's actually one of the, I think, key lectures in terms of setting up some of the basic mathematics here. So we'll try to get through the whole lecture today, and we can talk outside of class if we need to. So an important concept in signal processing is the representation of signals using fundamental building blocks such as sine waves, Fourier series. You can make use of sine waves and impulse functions, which will be really key for sampling theory. Now, I know at your stage in your education, the math is a bit of a problem, and I know some of you are thinking, I can't wait to get a job that doesn't use abstract mathematics and all that, but hopefully by the end of the semester, you'll appreciate how important these mathematical abstractions are to being able to design and optimize systems and to solve problems in a very general way. So just, try to bear with us, and when you have questions, no question is too basic. I've had students afraid to ask questions like when I write delta of t, asking me what t in the parentheses means. I mean, no question is too basic in this course. So when we get to something and you don't completely understand it, please ask questions, and we'll try to explain it in ways that you can understand it. Such representations allow us to gain insight into the complexity of a signal or approximate a signal with a lower fidelity version of itself. That's essentially what things like this MP3 player do. A very nice example of that are progressively scanned JPEGs. You watch as these things refresh themselves over time and the image gets better and better. And all of that's done by representing these signals, whether they're audio or images, as things like sine waves, so that you can add higher order terms and make the images better and better in quality. So by the end of the semester, I hope you'll be able to appreciate that. But to get to understand that, we have to teach you about things like Fourier series and such. So in today's lecture, we're going to begin with some very simple signals that can be used as these building blocks. Sine waves and delta functions are very fundamental to what we do in signal processing. We'll also discuss some basic properties of these signals, such as time shifting and basic operations such as integration and differentiation. And we will learn how to represent continuous time signals as discrete time signals. So let's go ahead and get into some of this. And again, please ask questions when something isn't clear. So, the impulse function. This is a very difficult thing to grasp sometimes, especially when the facts there aren't quite right. But hopefully, by the end of today, it'll make sense. So, a unit impulse, which is also known as a delta function or a Dirac distribution, is defined in a very simple way. It's defined with two key pieces of information. The first one, which is the easy one, is that delta of t, and that first character there should be delta. Delta of t is equal to zero when t is not equal to zero. So everywhere other than t equals zero, this function is zero. Now at zero, or close to zero, it has kind of an interesting property that the integral from minus epsilon to plus epsilon of delta of lambda d lambda is equal to one for any real number epsilon greater than zero. Now, what I've done is I've drawn a picture of this to the right. The way we define this impulse function is to essentially write it as a pulse of amplitude A and a width of A centered about zero. And then we let A go to zero. And what happens then is the function's amplitude goes off to infinity, but the width of the function becomes vanishingly small, so the product of these two stays constant and is equal to 1. So this is the impulse function can be approximated by a rectangular pulse with amplitude A and time duration 1 over A. But when we let A go to 0, what we essentially get is a function which we draw like this. It's a pulse at 0 with an infinite amplitude, but the area of that pulse is equal to a constant k. So when we write a k here, that simply means we have k times delta of t. So for any real number k, if we have k times delta of t and we integrate that from minus epsilon to plus epsilon, we get a constant k. So we're going to use these delta functions quite a lot this semester. So over time you'll become more comfortable with them. Now they're really important when we get to discrete time signals. So the definition of an impulse for a discrete time signal, which is actually a little bit easier than a continuous time case, again, assuming the fonts are all right here, we have delta of n is equal to 1 when n is equal to 0, and is equal to 0 when n is not equal to 0. So what that means is that we have a plot here which shows that the signal is 0 when n is not equal to 0, and it has a value of 1 when n is equal to 0. And these delta functions, and then this last thing which is off the bottom of the screen here, just says that the sum of delta of n for n is from minus infinity to plus infinity is equal to 1. So I think this is pretty easy to understand. It's just a signal that has a non-zero value at one point, n is equal to 0. The continuous time case, a little harder to understand, but both of these are the basis of how we represent signals. Digital signals will be represented this way. Continuous time signals will be represented as weighted sums of those impulse functions. So, let's now test your understanding of differentiation and integration by introducing the unit step and the unit ramp function. Now, we can define a unit step function as the integral of the unit impulse function. So we can write that u of t is equal to the integral from minus infinity to t of delta lambda d lambda. Now, let's think about that for a moment. I had a marker. So I have this unit pulse, and I define the integral from minus infinity to t. So let's suppose t is somewhere over here. This integral from minus infinity to t represents all of the signal up until this point. So if I compute the integral over this time, well, integration, as you recall, is simply the area under the curve. It's the area of the function. What is the area of this function when t is less than 0?
0.
Okay. That was easy, right? Now let's jump ahead and let's assume that the integral of this thing was some number. Let's ask the question, what happens when we're out here and we have the integral? Now we're going to take all of this stuff, so we're going to get 0, plus we're going to get something for this, but what's going to happen for t greater than 0?
There's actually,
if I ask the area
there
under this curve, well, it's going to be 0 plus whatever this thing is plus this, right? And this is 0. So what's going to happen is I increase t greater than 0. It's going to stay constant. So it's going to have a shape like this step function, this thing we showed to the right. Now the question is, what happens as we integrate through the time 0? Well, remember, what was our what was the definition of our impulse function?
The integral at 0 is 1.
We defined it as an area of 1. So at t equals 0, we're going to have the integral of the delta function, and that's 1. So we're going to go from 0 to 1, and then we're going to stay constant at 1. So the unit step function is the integral of the delta function. And both the impulse function and the unit step function are very important in signals and systems. For example, when you're looking for oil, sort of the old way they used to look for oil, what do? They do something very simple. They apply an impulse to the surface of the earth, and they measure the reflections that come back from that impulse, and then they figure out what type of geology is underneath the surface of the earth, and they can spot oil based on the types of reflections that they get. How do they do this? They explode charges on the surface of the earth. Those are impulse functions. And then they measure what comes back. So I always like to point out, why is an impulse function so important? Well, if you hit a system with an impulse and you measure what comes back, we'll see how that's very important in characterizing the system. You can do the same thing for room acoustics. If you want to measure the room acoustics here, when I pound the blackboard and I measure the signal that comes back, I get some information about the reverberation in this room. So the unit step function can be written compactly as u of t is equal to 0 when t is less than 0, and u of t is equal to 1 when t is greater than or equal to 0. And the derivative of the unit step function is an impulse function. So the two are related by an integral derivative type relationship. Yeah, that graphic's not showing up very well. The second graphic. Now, what happens if I integrate the step function? So let's think about that. We have a function which is 0, and then it becomes 1. So what's the integral going to be out here?
0.
So that was easy. So 1 is going to become non-zero.
0.
At 0.
And then it's a straight line.
And then what's going to happen when it's greater than 0? Well, remember, integration is the area under the curve. So if this is time t, what is the area here? Well, it's the height, which is 1, times the width, which is t. So the integral is just t. So we're going to have a ramp function. So the unit ramp function is simply the integral, what you get when you integrate a step function. And if you differentiate the unit ramp function, you get the unit step function. Yes?
I have a question about the unit pulse function.
Okay.
I guess, could you go back to the slide just before this? So how is the amplitude and the width defined on this to get the area under it to be exactly the one?
If you think of a rectangle, its height is epsilon and its width is 1 over epsilon. So delta t is what happens when you take the limit as epsilon goes to 0 of this thing, call it g of t. So what happens is as this thing shrinks in width, it grows in height.
Okay. So is its width 1 over epsilon, or is its height 1 over epsilon?
Actually, thank you.
I guess it wouldn't necessarily matter because it would still multiply out to 1.
Yeah, but I think it's
but then it would have infinite width.
Better to show this as epsilon 1 over epsilon, thanks. Yeah, I should update that figure. So as epsilon goes to 0, the height goes to infinity.
But
yeah, that picture is not doesn't really depict this as well.
Okay.
So when we talk about the unit, the impulse function, this is the picture that we talk about. And when we write, if you see a picture that looks, we'll talk about time shifting in a moment. But if you see a constant next to the pulse, it just means we multiplied it by some constant k. Okay? Good question.
Could you put those front lights off?
Yeah, actually I should have. I did that last time. Now it all makes sense, right? Okay, so the units, so let's now talk about discrete time. We can define a discrete time unit pulse to arrive at a discrete time unit step function. So we can write that this u, if you remember for the discrete time pulse, we just have a signal which has an amplitude of 1 at n equals 0. So the equivalent of integration in the discrete time sense is summation. So if we sum from m is equal to minus infinity to n, so we have a signal which is 0, and then it takes on a value of 1, and it's 0. So what happens if we pick a point, let's say here, and we sum up in this direction? We sum from minus infinity to this point, which we can call M. What is that sum equal to?
Zero,
right? So when will that sum become non-zero? When we reach time equals 0. So we have 0. And then at time equals 0, we have just this one term, 1. And then when we're out here somewhere, and we talk about the sum from minus infinity to m, the only term that's non-zero is this 1. So we're going to have a value of 1 for all time. So the summation of a unit pulse is a unit step function. And there I show kind of the mathematics of how you arrive at that. So to the right, we have a picture of the unit step function in the discrete time sense, which has a value of 1 for n greater than or equal to 0. Now, one of the interesting things we can do is we can define a time-limited pulse as the sum of two of these, one sort of in forward in time and one in reverse in time. We'll talk about that in a moment, but the unit pulse function is simply a signal which has non-zero values for some range of n, and that's an important signal when we talk about discrete time systems. Now, similarly, if we sum the unit step function from minus infinity to n, we arrive at the unit ramp function. Because once again, for time less than 0, we'll have 0. And then once we, for time greater than 0, at any point in time, we're just going to have the sum of these values 1. So the unit, the summation of the unit step function, it's off the bottom here a little bit, but we have simply the sum from 0 to n of the impulses which are non-zero, and therefore we get the value of n. So we get a unit ramp function when we integrate a unit step function. Now the other building block we want to talk about today are sines and cosines. Sine and cosine functions are of fundamental importance in signal processing because they're the basis of what we call a Fourier series. If you recall from last lecture, we're going to use this complex exponential quite a lot in this class. E to the j omega t is easily written as cosine omega t plus j sine omega t. That's a relationship I want you to get very comfortable with. The magnitude of e to the j omega t is just the magnitude of that complex number. Well, how do we compute the magnitude of a complex number? I give you a complex number, 3 plus 4j, how do you compute the magnitude?
So it's the represented rectangular.
That's one way. And
the root of the real part plus the root of the
imaginary. Real part squared plus the imaginary part squared, square root of that, exactly. So if I take the magnitude of this, I have cosine squared plus sine squared, which is just 1. Oh. So the magnitude of e to the j omega t is equal to 1. But its real and imaginary parts are cosine and sine, respectively. A sinusoid is an example of a periodic signal. In a general way that we will define a sinusoid is an amplitude times cosine of omega t plus theta. And you should be somewhat comfortable with that from your circuit analysis. One of the things we'll do this semester is tie together everything you've learned in circuit analysis using notions of sine waves. So a sinusoid is periodic with a period of 2 pi over omega, because if we write A times cosine omega times, instead of T, we put T plus 2 pi over omega, and we go through the decomposition of this, we can write this as A cosine omega T plus the omegas cancel and we have 2 pi plus theta. And we all know that the cosine of any number plus 2 pi is just equal to that number. So cosine is a periodic signal. Its period is 2 pi over omega. That doesn't quite show up here, but Series 2 pi over omega. Now later we will classify a sine wave as a deterministic signal because its values for all time are completely determined by its amplitude, its frequency, and its phase. And later we will also decompose signals into sums of sines and cosines using what's known as a trigonometric form of the Fourier series. So sines, cosines, complex exponentials, we're going to work a lot with those when we talk about Fourier series and Fourier transforms and things like that. Let me just say one more thing about... So if I take this cosine wave, what is the value of cosine at time equals zero? One, right? So what happens if I start increasing the phase of that cosine?
It slowly decreases.
And what happens when that phase reaches a value of 90 degrees?
Or zero.
What? It goes to zero and the cosine becomes
sine,
right? So cosines and sines are simply separated by 90 degree phase shift. And that's why we don't really worry about whether it's a cosine or a sine. They're both the same thing. They're just different by phase term.
Would it be a sine wave or a negative sine wave?
Let's get to that in the next slide. That's a good point. We're going to talk about time shifting, which is also some phase shifting. So, given a continuous time signal, x of t, now, let me point out, this lecture, this slide is an example of a fairly simple mathematical abstraction that I know you're going to struggle with for several weeks. So, just hang in there and take it one step at a time. Whenever you're dealing with mathematical abstractions like functions and you're not sure what's going on, plot the function. Draw some pictures. And that way you can understand what's really going on versus trying to guess what's going on. Now the slide's a little bit distorted here, but what we want to consider is if we have a function u of t, we know u of t looks like this unit step. If I write the function u of t minus 2, what is that function going to look like? So, well, there's a picture, of course, but how did we arrive at that picture? Well, it's first of all, it's still a unit step function, so it has to look like a unit step function. The only question is, where does it begin and end? Well, we could think about that abstractly, or we could just plug in a few values. When t is equal to 0, and I generally prefer to plug in values and then think about things abstractly. Once I know the answer, then I can sort of figure out all the associated theory. So, u of t is equal, at t is equal to 0, goes from 0 to 1, right? So u of t minus 2, if t is equal to 0, u of t minus 2 is u of minus 2, right? And u of minus 2 is equal to what? Well, u of minus 2 is over here. U of minus 2 is equal to 0. If t is equal to 1, u of t minus 2 is equal to u of minus 1. U of minus 1 is equal to 0. If t is equal to 2, to let's say 3, u of t minus 2 is equal to u of 1. T minus 2, 3 minus 2 is equal to 1. U of 1 is equal to 1. So u of t minus 2, how is that related to u of t? Well, it's simply u of t shifted to the right, shifted forward in time by 2 seconds. Similarly, u of t plus 2 is simply shifted back it starts at minus 2. Now, the philosophical question is this shifted forward in time or backwards in time? We all can agree on right and left, that's easy. Which function happens earlier in time?
U of t plus 2.
U of t plus 2, because it starts at minus 2, which is earlier than plus 2. So So the right picture actually represents shifting the function so that it starts earlier in time. And the left picture implies delaying the function because it's happening later in time. Now, another sort of related property from this, which is really garbled up here pretty badly on the slide, is what we call the sifting property. The sifting property states that the integral from t1 minus epsilon to t1 plus epsilon of some function f of lambda times the delta function t minus lambda d lambda is equal to, and the question will be, what is this equal to? Well, this is equal to the function evaluated at t1 or any epsilon greater than 0. Now, this is not so difficult to prove because we can note that f of lambda times delta of t minus lambda, okay, I know a lot of mathematics there, but this delta of t minus lambda, when is this non-zero?
Lambda, right?
Well, yes, let's think about right if, you're lambda, if you're struggling with lambda, let me just write this as delta of t minus 2. For what value of t is this non-zero?
2.
So lambda.
So therefore, the value of t, this is non-zero, is lambda. So this is just equal to, so when lambda is equal to t, this thing is non-zero, so this is just equal to f of t. So this function only has one non-zero value, and that's f of t1. And we know that the integral of delta at t1 is equal to 1. So this is just f of t1. So here's an example, and I've got the full proof in the slide, so you can go through that after class. But this is an example of how we can combine our knowledge of the delta function and our knowledge of time shifting to show a very nice property called the sifting property, that whenever you multiply a function by a delta function and integrate it, you just get the value of that function. And we'll make use of this when we derive things like convolution. So we'll come back to this, but I just show you this as an example of how we can totally confuse you with some complicated math based on some simple principles. But, and that's pretty bad. Let's see. This is not. Let me see what's next.
Anybody else?
Yeah,
I wonder if that's going to type function.
So, a continuous time signal x of t is discontinuous at a point, at a fixed point, if you think about a function like our step function, the question is what happens at this point in time. If you approach the function from this direction, it looks like the value of the function is 0. If you approach the function from this direction, it looks like the value is 1. So this is an example of a function that's discontinuous at this point. Call that t1. So a signal that is continuous for all points t is said to be a continuous signal. Not surprising. But note that we use continuous in two ways here. We use continuous to refer to the amplitude of the function and the time domain. So we talk about a discrete time signal as being discontinuous in the time axis, and we talk about discontinuous signal as also being not continuous in the amplitude axis. Now the ramp function, interestingly enough, the ramp function is a continuous function because at time zero, it has one value, zero. But the unit step, the unit impulse are discontinuous functions. And sine waves, of course, are examples of continuous signals. So about half of this course deals with continuous signals, meaning signals which are continuous in the time domain and mostly continuous in amplitude as well. And then another half of the course deals with discrete time signals, which are discontinuous in time domain. A signal is said to be piecewise continuous if it is continuous over some interval. So here, for example, we have a signal which is continuous in these regions, but discontinuous at these boundaries. So you'll hear sometimes people say, we're going to make a piecewise continuous approximation. And that makes analysis a little easier. Now, we can extend this concept to the notion of differentiable. So a continuous time signal is said to be differentiable at a fixed point t1 when you take the derivative at t1 and you take the limit as h goes to 0, essentially the values that you converge to as h goes to 0, if that has a limit. And this needs to be independent of whether h approaches 0 from h greater than 0 or h less than 0. To be differentiable at a point t1, it is necessary but not sufficient that the signal be continuous at t1. So you've probably seen this in calculus and forgotten about it, but we won't lean on this too much this semester, but we do want to make sure you understand what differentiation means, because we'll use that a lot this semester. Piecewise continuous signals are not differentiable at all points because they're only piecewise continuous, but can have a derivative in the generalized sense. And I won't dwell on that today because the slide is kind of messed up. But we can actually derive a notion of a generalized derivative for signals that are discontinuous. And we will make use of that when we talk a little bit about Fourier series, but we won't really dwell on that too much because it's more of a theoretical fine point. But derivatives are very important in signal processing, and we'll make use of them frequently throughout the semester. Now, the last thing that we want to do today, I think this is the last slide. This is a really nice example of how we can build discrete time signals out of impulse functions. So when we talk about the signal that's stored in this MP3 player, you're essentially given amplitude values of that signal as a function of time. So if you look in the file, you'll see numbers, the value of the signal has a value of -1 at time 2, -2 at time 3, +4 at time 4, and so forth. But we need a mathematical way to represent that kind of a signal so we can operate on the signal mathematically. So what we're going to do is to actually represent discrete time signals as weighted sums of pulses. So let's see how we can get to that point. So one of the most common ways in which discrete time signals arise is a sampling of a continuous time signal. The recordings of my voice in this recorder are samples of a continuous time signal, which is the sound pressure wave that you're hearing transmitted through this room. In this case, the samples are spaced uniformly at time intervals t sub n is equal to n times capital T, where t is the sampling interval and 1 over t is the sampling frequency and n is an integer. Now, for these recordings, that when you talk about something like an MP3 file, what kind of sample frequency is being used? When you talk about a CD, maybe start with something simpler. When we talk about a CD, which amazingly to me, that's old technology, you guys. What sample frequency was used for CDs? 44.1 kilohertz. And there's a really interesting story about how that happened we can talk about offline. What sampling frequency is used for voice over the analog telephone network? 8 kilohertz. And when you're using your cell phones, what sample frequency is used?
6, maybe?
It actually uses 8K, but it compresses the data using a compression algorithm. So 8K is essentially, or 44.1 kilohertz, is the time, 1 over that is the time those samples are spaced. Samples can be spaced uniformly, or they can also be non-uniformly spaced. But we'll talk mostly in this class about uniform sampling. Now, we can write this kind of a signal mathematically. We're going to use x bracket n close bracket. We can write this as x of, this is shorthand notation for x of t evaluated when t is equal to n times capital T. So we could also write this as n times x of n times capital T. But most of the time, we'll drop the t and we'll just write x of n. Now later in this course, we will introduce the sampling theorem, and that is a theorem which tells us how we can sample x of t so that we can recover x of t perfectly from the digital signal. And that's essentially the principle, that's sort of the enabler for all of digital audio, is the fact that you can digitize my voice, manipulate it on a computer, and then resynthesize my voice and get back exactly the same signal. And the sampling theorem tells us how to do that. And once we can do that, it now becomes very attractive to process signals digitally versus analog. And I think there's a great, great example of that. How many of you are now using the digital decoders for the analog broadcast television? Anybody hook those up yet? And most of you probably getting satellite. Well, I live out in the country, so I'm stuck with analog TV. And we connected up our digital converter box this over the break. And it's amazing, the improvement in picture quality. We went from this horrible distorted analog signals to really, really high quality digital signals. And that's an example of why it's preferable to use digital processing. We can do a lot more in terms of making the signal higher quality and more reliable in the same amount of bandwidth. And it's all enabled because through the sampling theorem we know how to go from the digital signal back to the analog signal, which is ultimately what you're going to view when you're watching your television. So what we've done today is we've discussed representation of signals using some fundamental building blocks. We've introduced 4 very important signals: impulse, unit step, ramp, and a sine wave. And we've introduced both continuous time and discrete time versions of these. We introduced a mathematical representation called time shifting, and we introduced the sifting property. Now, you'll see the sifting property a couple more times, so you'll have a little bit more time to get comfortable with that. But it's a very useful property that's coupled to the behavior of the delta function. We discussed the concept of a continuous signal and noted that many of our building blocks, like unit, like impulse and step, are discontinuous at some point in time. And then we introduced the concept of a derivative and noted that the derivative of a discrete time signal is a little bit more complicated because discrete time signals are essentially discontinuous in time. And then we talked a little bit about how we're going to represent discrete time signals using sampling. Okay, I will see you on Monday, and on Monday we'll continue building on top of these representations and talk about system properties.